Well, they said we are a speaker meeting. It's going to fall on me to introduce our speaker tonight. Actually, it gives me a great deal of pleasure to introduce this gentleman to you tonight. Kind of wandered into our meetings a little while back. Has become a regular member for the Higgler groups. It's always nice to see him in a meeting. I always enjoy his calm and thoughtful delivery of his when he shares, and I'm really looking forward to hearing his share tonight. And I know that he celebrated a major milestone in his journey very recently. So I'm going to leave him to share that with you. But he's going to share with us his experience, strength, and hope journey two into Narcotics Anonymous. Whatever he's comfortable with for 40, 45 minutes. So Keith, the floor is yours, my friend. Please unmute yourself and jump in and share.
Thanks, Steve. I'm Keith. I'm recovering from addiction. Hello, everybody.
Hello,
Hi,
Keith.
Hi, Keith.
Hi,
Keith.
Keith. Hi, Keith.
As was mentioned, my clean date is July 4th, 2000. So yesterday I celebrated 25 years clean. And I've been the last day or two, I've been really thinking a lot about my first year. It was 2000, so the flat book, the step working guides, had only been out for just about 2 years when I got clean, and it still hadn't been widely adopted. Most of the people with a lot of time up had been doing step work responses a certain way, and there was a little reticence to use the step working guides because it was new. And there was another group of people that I respected, who old timers, were taking each other through the workbook. Because there's a philosophy that a lot of people in Narcotics Anonymous share, which is that they don't want to give assignments that they haven't done themselves. I don't sponsor that way, but I respect people who do. And my sponsor, I was the first person that he took through the workbook. He's sponsored, many, many people since through it. And the part of the workbook that really kind of stuck in my mind as I was thinking about it this week is the unmanageability section. I remember looking at those. There's like 15 questions in the unmanageability section, and I remember I thinking to myself, I do not want to answer these questions. I mean, there's a question in there is that says, "Have I ever harmed someone because of my addiction? Describe." I mean, I'm in my first step. I don't have any ability to get in touch with the truth for that question. I mean, I really didn't have it. And I struggled with that unmanageability section. It took me a while. I mean, there were what, 69, 67 questions in the first step in the flat book. And it took me a while. It's a lot of work and it's a lot of writing. And, I was still kind of detoxing. Everybody's detox time is their own, but it took me a while, to physically detox. And then there's, kind of the mental detox that takes even longer, at least it did for me. And I had gotten fired from my job, so I wasn't working. And so I spent those first 3 or 4 months of my recovery basically hanging out at our little clubhouse. We call it was a Just for Today clubhouse. There were meetings there, at 7 a.m., at noon, at 3 p.m., at 5 p.m. And so I really just spent a lot of time at the clubhouse because I didn't know what to do with myself. I didn't have a job. I didn't have any money. And the truth is, I had lost most of my friends because, people only put up with dope fiend bullshit for so long. And so I hung out there. And whenever another addict said, "Hey, we're going to go, get a hamburger. Do you want to come with us?" I'd say, "Yeah, sure." And so, those first 90 days, first 120 days, I just worked on my first step. I hung out at the clubhouse and I did the best that I could. I couldn't sleep. I don't know if it's happened to you, but for me, I really, really had a hard time sleeping. And so I'd get up and I'd go to that 7 o'clock morning in the meeting morning, the meeting in the morning. And that just kind of set the tone for the day, and I was grateful for that. I did not like you people. When I got clean, I did not want to be there. The truth of the matter is, there was a guy that I knew back then. He was from the Elder Fellowship, and he told me that I had a a problem with drugs and resentment, and that maybe I should consider going to Narcotics Anonymous. And I did, you know, and I called that guy on my birthday every year for 12 years to thank him for carrying the message to me. And because it's made all the difference in my life. And I don't know him anymore, but I think of him and I'm very grateful for him. And but I finally got through my first step, and then came time to do the second step. And one of the things we do out here in Colorado, it's very common during the second step and or the seventh step or the 11th step, is to take a pilgrimage to the desert in New Mexico. And that's what I did, because a lot of other people I knew had done that. And so I went to New Mexico, and I prayed and meditated in a lot of kind of spiritual places, because throughout the southwestern United States and up into California, there are all of these ancient churches. And most people believe that, you know, the monks who built those churches back in the day built them where they did for a very particular reason. So when you go and you stand in these places, you can kind of feel the spiritual energy. You can feel why they chose that spot for the church. And, you know, and there's this place in a little town called Chimayo, and there's a little church there. And you go into the basement and you take a little vial and you collect some of the dirt and you take it with you. And it gets blessed on the way out. And I did that. And it was a really interesting experience of rituals. And it was really kind of my first exposure to spiritual ritual, which is something I've learned a lot more about as a member of Narcotics Anonymous. And the other thing that happened during my second step is I really didn't have a higher power of my own. I didn't understand that until I got into the second step, you know, that I had kind of this spiritual belief that I had borrowed from the people that I used to get high with. And I didn't think that was going to work anymore. And so my sponsor said, look, he said, I don't care what you choose for a higher power, but my suggestion is that you choose one. And so I started going to this Thursday night, 6:30 meditation meeting. And I just went and I meditated, and, you know, and at some point I had pretty serious spiritual experience. The way I like to describe it now is, I was claimed. A higher power kind of appeared to me, basically said, you belong to me now. Like, okay. And that's just kind of what happened. And that power is still with me today. You know, I don't pretend to understand it or how it works, or even why it works. It just works, you know. And as some of you know, I had hip surgery recently, and I had postponed it like 3 times because I didn't have courage and faith. And I was kind of having trouble finding my higher power. It's like, oops, where's my higher power? And it took many, many, many months of prayer to kind of reconnect in a way where I could get what I needed. Because I don't know about you guys, but I cannot self-generate spiritual principles. I need to get those from a higher power. And it took a long time. And I was frustrated. But eventually, I got back hooked up with my higher power. And I was given what I needed to confidently do the surgery. Courage and faith, because that's what I needed. And I'm still recovering from it, but I'm doing well. And so I remember going to my sponsor and saying, you know, I have a higher power now. And he's like, great. And I remember asking him, are you not interested in the details? He said, no, it's none of my business. My business is to tell you to get a higher power. After that, I don't need to know. And I really, that stuck with me. That idea that just because I'm sponsoring you doesn't mean I need to know the details of your spiritual practice. That's between you and your higher power. You don't need to tell anybody. And I really, really was attracted to the idea, and I still am. I never ask people about their higher power. Now, if you were to come to my house, you would look at my altar and you could easily see what my higher power is. But otherwise, I don't really talk about the details. And I'm never going to ask you about your details because it's none of my business. You know, it just really isn't. And I like that about Narcotics Anonymous, that we're not overly focused on each other's higher powers. I think that's a really good thing. But, you know, I made it through the second step. And I remember coming out of the second step, and I felt better because I had been so empty, you know, after the first step. There was that big gaping hole inside of me. after the first step. And I've heard lots of addicts talk about that. And but I started to feel better after the second step. And it took me about 90 days to do the first step. I mean, I wrote every day. I wrote every day. And it didn't take me quite as long to do the second step. And then, the holidays are coming up, and I'm in the third step. And I struggled with the third step because this idea, what does turning my will and my life over actually mean? I mean, in day-to-day life, what does that mean? And it took me a long time. And so my sponsor gave me this assignment to go talk to 15 addicts. And he said, it doesn't have to be people you know. And ask them about their third step. Ask them what their third step means to them. Ask them what turning their will and their life over me had meant to them. And so that's what I did because I didn't know what else to do because I couldn't make my way through the third step on my own. I really needed experience, faith, and hope from other addicts. And I got it. By the time I had spoken to the 15th person, I had finished all the writing and the workbook, and I was ready to do my third step. And there just happened to be my sponsor was away that weekend, I think. And he said, look, Keith, you don't need to do it anywhere. You don't need to go anywhere. You can just sit in your little meditation cushion and turn your will and your life over. And that's what I did. It wasn't a big deal. There were no fireworks. It was kind of a quiet, contemplative act, but it was an action. The third step is an action step. And so, and I remember talking to my sponsor about how it felt afterwards. And I remember describing a sense of lightness. I didn't feel as heavy. I didn't feel as much weight on my shoulders, and I was grateful. So here I am, 6 months clean. I just finished my third step, and it's time to start thinking about the fourth step. And then something kind of happened in that period that I started my fourth step, and the way my sponsor decided to do it, because I was almost 43 years old by the time I started my first fourth step, and so there was a lot to write about. There's a lot of garbage. And my sponsor knew that this first set of steps was going to be very long for me. And there was going to be a lot of writing because I came to it at an older age. And so we he decided that it would be best to do it one section at a time and then go over it. He told me that normally he would wait till the end, but he felt that I would benefit greatly from just going over each topic and each section one at a time without waiting till the end. And I think that was probably the right thing to do. And so, here I am, I'm going to meetings every day. I'm working on my fourth step. And then my sponsor says, you need to get a job. I'm like, what are you talking about? He said, see those? And he would point to people in the room and say, see these people here? They all have jobs. You're the only person in this meeting that doesn't have a job. And my unemployment had run out, and so I had to get a job, and the area in my life where addiction had caused the most harm to me was in the realm of employment and career, and one of the things that happened in that first four step is my sponsor made me do a job inventory because he knew it was a big issue. I had had 65 jobs from the time I was 14 to the time I was 42. And these are, jobs with a paycheck and deductions and everything. And I remember my sponsor was shocked. I'm like, I couldn't hold a job. I could always get a job. I couldn't hold it because I was impossible to deal with. I was impossible to deal with. I could not interact successfully with other human beings in the work environment. I could not. And a second thing happened as I was working on my first four step. I decided that I wanted a hot NA girlfriend, and for my sins, God gave me one. And when she was done with me, I'd never want another one. And I remember my sponsor saying, he said, Keith, I don't recommend that you do what you're about to do. He said, but if you are going to do it, just keep working on your fourth step. He says, as long as you keep going to meetings and keep writing, you might make it through. And of course, the kicker is she had 90 days clean. And that seemed like a good idea to me. That's how disconnected from reality I was, even, you know, with 9 months clean, thinking that was a good idea. It was not a good idea. She broke up with me every 30 days for 6 months. And it was a nightmare. But I got out of it clean because I kept going to meetings and I kept writing on my fourth step. And, you know, and I've never been involved with a person in NA ever again. And I learned my lesson. You know, I was in no shape to do that. And I'm grateful that I got out clean. You know, and I just kept, you know, working on my fourth step. It took me, I think, 9 months to do my fourth step, and it filled up an entire thick notebook. And it was painful, you know, and one of the memories I have, you know, of fifth stepping with my sponsor, because there's a lot more to the fifth step than just, you know, reciting the fourth step. I remember my sponsor, he would always know when I skipped something that I'd written. And I'd be like, how do you know that I skipped that? He says, your body language changes. And I didn't know that. And that's a skill that we develop in sponsorship, is we can tell when a sponsee is trying to hide something because the body language changes. And so he taught me how to notice that. I've been very grateful for him for that. Now he and then I did the fifth step, and then came six. Oh my goodness. You know, I was one big walking character defect, you know, and what we call character defect, I called Keith, you know, because I had so many of them and I had been, you know, relying on those character defects my entire life to make my way, to survive, to cope. And the idea of letting them go, the idea was unthinkable to me because I didn't know any other way to live. And I really struggled in that first six step. Because I would do this writing and I would look at the page and I would feel so bad. You know, during my sixth step, that self-loathing of the self-centeredness coin, because self-loathing is part of self-centeredness too. I didn't really learn that or understand that until I was in the sixth step, because my self-loathing just took off as I was going through the sixth step. I mean, I was right back to standing in front of the mirror saying, you're a fucking piece of shit, Keith. And it was a very difficult time to go through that sixth step. And, but, you know, I made it through. But, and I remember learning a really important lesson. I was in a meeting and I heard this guy share about the sixth step, and he was talking about that anything that I don't put on the table in the sixth step isn't going to get dealt with in seven, and I'm going to have to carry it around. And that blew my mind, just blew my mind, because of course it's true, right? We hear things in the rooms that we just intuitively know are true, and that was true. And I left a really big thing off of my first sixth step, which was how I felt about myself. I did not put that down there, because self-hatred is a profound character defect. But I didn't understand that, because I had felt that way about myself my whole life. It didn't feel like a character defect. It felt, that's me. And that's how I see myself. And I remember my sponsor stopped me before I completed the sixth step and gave me a side assignment, because that happens sometimes. Sometimes when we're working on a particular step, if we've got a good sponsor, they'll notice that we need to step back and do something else for a minute. And that's what he had me do. He had me do this inventory of my feelings as far back as I could remember them, to try to understand when I started feeling this way about myself. And we could trace it all the way back to about first grade. And I had done this thing when I was in first grade. I lived in the poor neighborhood. And so we had to cross this little creek over this bridge to get to where the school was, because the school was in the middle-class neighborhood. And they had these nice houses. And I remembered so strongly, just raging with resentment, I'm 6 years old and I'm raging with resentment. And I used to go, and so I started opening up their mailboxes and tearing their mail in half and putting it back in. Well, in the United States, you can't do that. And so the FBI showed up at my house, our little poor house. And I remember I was hiding under the bed and I saw their wingtip shoes. It's like this burned into my memory. And so, you know, they gave me a good lecture about, you know, why you can't do that to people's mail. It's a felony. I'm 6 years old, so they're not going to prosecute me. And that was the first time I realized that I hated myself, number one. But number two, you know, that was clearly evidence of the disease of addiction. And so I am definitely one of those people that says, you know, the disease of addiction was active in my life before, long before I got high. I mean, I didn't get high the first time until I was 12. And so, so there was that 6 year period before I got high where the disease of addiction was evident, but there was no one around me that could see it. So, you know, so I continued to feel that way and I continued to act out and I continued to behave as if I was in active addiction, even though I wasn't yet. So, you know, I remember feeling this incredible sense of relief when I got to the seventh step, because I'm still going to that Thursday night meditation at 6:30. And, you know, an interesting little sidebar about that meditation. I don't know how it is now with meditation meetings because I haven't been to one for a while. We don't really have one here in Denver anymore. But back then, there was, you know, very keen interest in what was going on inside of a meditation meeting, you know, to make sure there were no tradition violations going on. And so we couldn't like play a meditation tape or anything like that. Obviously that's, you know, an affiliation and endorsement. We can't do that. So they found this machine that makes sounds. It just makes sounds and that aren't associated with anything. And so they had this sound machine and it sounded kind of odd, but after a while you kind of got used to it. And so I went to that meeting regularly during my seventh step. And the other thing that had happened, you know, this is, you know, coming up to my second convention. At my second convention, we did my seventh step. There's this place in Colorado Springs, called the Garden of the Gods. It's this really extraordinary a structure of rocks, these beautiful red rocks. And so it's a little dicey what hiking in them, but we hiked up into the Garden of the Gods and did my seven steps. It's a very powerful spiritual experience. And I'm kind of grateful for that. A lot of people here where I live in Colorado are very attached to the outdoors. You know, we have these spectacular mountains and so most people will do something in 2, 7, 11 in the mountains. Because it's there's something inherently spiritual about nature that you don't get in the city. I don't even know how to describe it, except it's the vibration. It's just different. And so I was very grateful at that second convention to go do my seventh step. It was a powerful experience, and I felt I remember afterwards feeling like I trusted my sponsor more now that I had done a seventh step with him. And that was a good feeling to finally kind of admit that, yeah, I kind of trust this guy. I mean, it took a while, a couple of years or 16, 18 months. But there was a sense of relief that I felt for, you know, having that level of trust in my sponsor. And, you know, and then I started my eighth step and the shit hit the fan. You know, people would tell me over and over and over, it's just a list, Keith, write your damn list. I'm like, it's not just a list for me. And I really struggled getting the support that I needed because people were kind of closed-minded to the idea that anyone would struggle in the eighth step. But I struggled. I struggled so far, so much that I lost my job. I became homeless and really just not functioning. And, but I kept going to meetings and I kept working on my step. Finally, I got through it. And in the end, I understood what it was about. I had to put people on my list who had harmed me. And I did not want to do that. And I got really messed up about that. And I'm actually surprised that I made it through that claim, because I was so messed up. Because, you know, when I was a kid, people did some fucked up shit to me. That's just what happened. And that was the first time in the eighth step where that stuff that had been layered, you know, hidden under layer and layer of denial started to surface in that first eighth step. And I, you know, I wasn't ready to deal with that then. You know, I wouldn't be ready to deal with that, those things that had been done to me until another set of steps. But, and so I was living, I was going from place to place. I was doing some house sitting and, you know, cause I all my stuff was in storage, and I had left my apartment owing them money. And I very much felt like a dope fiend. Like, have I not learned anything? And I remember I was staying in my friend's basement, and you know, I'd finished my eighth step, and I had done my writing on my ninth step. So, you know, I'm homeless for months and months and months and months. And, you know, here's a tip. Your friends don't want you staying in their basement. You know, for a night or two, it's fine. After that, they want you out. It's not that they didn't love me. They don't want me in their basement. You know, it took me years to repair one of those relationships because I was living in their basement. And I was still pretty messed up, you know, emotionally, psychologically. And I remember my sponsor came to me one day and said, look, Keith, you know, are you ready to start doing your ninth step work? He said, you've done all the writing. You know, it's all there on your index cards. And that's how we do it here. We put them on index cards. You know, we write the harm on one side and we write the amends on the other side. And we're taught to only read what's written on the card. And I really like that. Because that, you know, that gives us boundaries to get in and out of a ninth step experience with another person safely. And the other thing that I had to do that I didn't want to do was I had to go back home. I had to go where I was born and raised and where all the harm was done to me. I did not want to go there. I did not want to go. I started having nightmares. And I'd be sitting in a Narcotics Anonymous meeting in my hometown, and the whole room would be full of all the men who abused me and kicked the shit out of me. It was horrible nightmares. But in the end, you know, there was only one way, there's only one path through. It's either go back to using or walk through this very painful amends situation. So I went back to where I'm from, which is Michigan, and I made a bunch of amends. And you know, when my my brother and my birth mother, you know, I made amends with them, and I asked them that question. You know, the question we ask: what can I do to right these wrongs? What can I do to make things right between us? And they both said the same thing: we'd like you to stay around for a while. And I called my sponsor, and I'm like, "What am I going to do?" He's like, and he said exactly what he always says. He's like, "What are you willing to do to stay clean? What are you willing to do to stay clean?" And so I had to, I spent 15 months there, and I hated it, but I had no choice because I wanted to stay clean. And I knew my sponsor was right, that if I refused that request, that things might not go well for me and I might go back to using. And I did not want to go back to using. And so I rented a little apartment about 2 hours away from my relatives. So there's a nice distance there, but I can still, they can still see me a couple times a week. And that made my mother happy. And it was interesting. I would go see my mother a couple times a week, and we would sit at the Big Boy restaurant and, you know, have a piece of pie or maybe a hamburger and talk. And I actually got to know her in those 15 months. And I got answers to a lot of my questions, because we all have questions about our parents, right? And I remember one day I looked at her and I said, you know, when I was 11, you tried to kill yourself. Why did you do that? And she told me she had fallen in love with a married man and he had dumped her. And I had been carrying that anger about that since I was 11 years old. I was so angry that she had done that. And it's one of the reasons I left home, you know, at 14. And then I started to understand, you know, that the amends process isn't just about trying to make things right with them, that there are benefits to us as well internally. And I got to let go of anger that I'd been carrying around for more than 30 years because I didn't understand it. Didn't understand why those things had happened. And so, you know, I stayed there 15 months. And in the end, I had to go to them and say, look, I'm going back to Colorado. That's my home. This isn't my home anymore. And of course, you know, I started going to meetings there. I did what, you know, what you guys taught me to do. I got a home group. I started, I picked up, I became an H&I panel coordinator in Michigan. You know, I kept doing the deal. And I actually have one friend, really close friend from those days, that is still my friend and was here to visit me last year. And after that, my relationship with my mom and my brother changed, and for the better. And I was able to see her as I was able to see her humanity in a way that I didn't before. And you know, my brother and I, we didn't, you know, I left home at 14. He was 9 years old when I left. So, you know, in a very real sense, we didn't really grow up together. So we're close, but not as close as we might have been. And but that amends process was immensely important to me. And so, you know, I came back to Colorado. Of course, I started making amends here. And it took me a while to make a lot of amends, but I did it to the best of my ability. And some people would not meet with me. It happens, right? Because, you know, surprise, surprise, not everybody wants to see me again. I remember when I came home and I met with my sponsor, because I kept the same sponsor. You know, I would sit on the porch of this little place I'd rented, and I would call Denver every day, four or five people, you know, and that helped me get through that whole period of time. And I came home and I started doing more amends. And I remember the first amends I made when I got home from Michigan was to a woman, and this goes back to like 1984. And I contacted her and explained who I was and why I was contacting her, and you know, and requested that you know she meet me so that I could make direct amends to her. And she wrote me an email back saying, "I forgive you, bye." And all of a sudden, you know, and then her website went down. She just like disappeared. And I thought, you know, and I learned that lesson. Not everyone wants to see me. Not everyone is interested in my amends. Not everyone is interested in the fact that I'm in recovery, you know, and that was a tough pill to swallow, you know, because I think I still had a idealized view of myself in recovery that everybody else would think it was great. Turns out a lot of people just aren't interested. So, you know, so I moved on to the 10th step. And I had been doing the 10th step out of the IP for years, you know, and so this time I did it formally. And but I remember when I came back, people noticed a difference in me after making amends to my family. I was changed by that experience. And it took me a while to see the change in myself, but I realized that, you know, the amends process is that critical juncture in my recovery where that internal change really starts to happen. And I was grateful for it. So, you know, I get back and it's, you know, it's fall of 2005 now, I'm working on my 11th step. And then I did my 12th step. And I remember we have this concert venue out here called Red Rocks, right? It's up in you know, in the foothills, and there's all these red rocks, and it's a natural amphitheater. Sound quality is incredible. So I went up there and I did my 12th step with my sponsor in the rain under a tree at Red Rocks. It was a powerful experience, you know, and for me, there is nothing like hearing your sponsor say, "Congratulations. You've completed the 12 steps in Narcotics Anonymous." And I remember years later asking him how many people he's, you know, gotten all the way through the steps. And at that time, he said he'd sponsored like 30 guys, and me and two other guys were the only ones that ever made it to the steps. And I couldn't understand that. I still don't understand. I mean, why would you deny yourself the extraordinary benefits of working 1 through 12? And the only answer I could come up with is the disease of addiction, you know, gets in the way of working the steps. And, you know, and by then, you know, I came back and I got a job, you know, and I parlayed that into another job and lost that job. So I was still having problems in work environments, even though I'd completed a set of steps, you know, because there's more work to do, right? More will be revealed. That's what we say. And the second, you know, the first job that I had in recovery, I rage quit. Because they had put a list of my character defects in front of me in a meeting. And I'm like, oh man. So I just walked because I couldn't cope with it. The second job I had, I left on good terms. The third job I had, I got fired, but I had done really well at the job. I just made one screw up with a customer and they had to fire me. And I had kind of a depression, and I realized that my self-worth was still very much tied up in work life, that if I was doing okay at work, I felt good about myself. And you know, and eventually I have to do some work outside the program about that. And and so I was able to go back to work for the company that I'd worked for previously, and I worked there for oh heck, 3.5 years. Now, at the time, that was the longest job that I'd ever had. And I had my ups and downs, and I left well, but there were still people there that were very glad to see me leave. But I kept getting better. And that's the point. That's what happens to us in Narcotics Anonymous. As we stay clean and go to meetings and do service and work steps, we get better. It just takes time. It doesn't happen overnight. It takes years. But I was getting better, you know? And then I started another set of steps. And when I got into the second step, in the second set of steps, it all came out. What had been done to me as a child. And the fact that I had been raped when I was 14 years old. I had buried that stuff under so much crap that it just came running out. And I remember the people that knew me were like, "What is wrong with Keith? It's just a second step." They couldn't understand because they hadn't been abused. Oh, you know, and so I did what I was taught to do. I sought out men in the program who had been abused like I was, because we know who we are. We can tell when you sit in a meeting with men who have been abused. We recognize each other. I don't know how to describe it, but something about the way we use language and something about the way we sit and look at each other. And so I started meeting with a guy who had been abused worse than me. And he helped me so much. And he got me to a professional that can continue that help. And you know, I saw that professional for half a dozen years. And we dealt with all kinds of issues, but we started with abuse, you know. And I remember, you know, we had found out that the man who had raped me was a serial predator and that he had raped a lot of teenage boys. And that he was in prison. And I felt such a sense of relief. I felt such a sense of safety because as long as he was out there, I wasn't safe. I wasn't safe. And I was so relieved for that sense of safety because I never felt safe in my life. And slowly but surely over time, I started to feel safe within the walls of Narcotics Anonymous. And I was grateful for that. You know, and I kept working that set of steps. And I kept changing, you know, and right at the, you know, and then I finished that set of steps and I finished the work that I'd been doing outside of the program. And I had like 18 years clean. And I was like, okay, I'm finally feeling good. I have a good job. I paid off all my debts, made all my financial amends, made most of my amends that can be made. I'm doing okay. And then I got cancer. I was so pissed. I'm still pissed about that. Just when I get to the point where my recovery has really worked the change that you guys tell me about. I was somewhere close to happy, joyous, and free on a daily basis. And then I get canceled. I was so pissed. But that's just what happened. And I didn't realize at the time, but that was the life-changing moment because illness and recovery became my life. And it still is. That's always my primary topic now, as many of you know, because there's no getting around it. My cancer's in remission, but the chemotherapy damaged my brain, gave me kidney disease and osteoporosis. That's why I had to get a hip replacement because my hip started shattering because of the osteoporosis caused by the chemotherapy. And I have a lot of other medical conditions. And that's just the way it is. I didn't get mad at God when I got cancer. God doesn't give people cancer. That's just what happened. And I know why I got bladder cancer, because I smoked cigarettes. 85% of bladder cancers in men are caused by tobacco. I did it to myself. And talk about a head fuck. It took me a long time to get beyond that I had done this to myself and to forgive myself. And, because that's one of the fundamental things that happens in Narcotics Anonymous, as you work the steps and you work the steps, you begin the process of forgiving myself. And it's a hugely important thing. And it takes a long time because there's a lot to forgive, right? So, and so here I am again. I'm healing from a surgery and I'm doing okay. But this is my life now. I'm 67. I'm sick. I move slowly. I don't do anything fast anymore. I only go to one meeting, one in-person meeting a week, which is my home group, occasionally a second. But, since the days of the pandemic, my recovery has been online. And before that, before the pandemic, I started going to, in 2015, I'd started going to the NA by phone meetings here in the United States. And I did that for 5 years. And then Zoom came along. And so, where I'm at today is, I have my notebook and a pen sitting right there on my desk, ready to start a second set, another set of steps. And I haven't started yet. So I'm praying for willingness because I've decided that I need to do another set of steps. Because the truth of the matter is, my friends, I have not written about being sick. And I need to write about that. And the only practice, and I tried working out of the Living Clean book, chapter four, our physical selves. I do this thing where you read a paragraph, write a paragraph, read a paragraph, write a paragraph. And I did that for a chunk of that chapter. But when it got to the illness section of that chapter, I stopped. So clearly, I have some sort of block inside of me about not wanting to write about being sick. But it's the biggest thing in my life and has been for 7 years, and I need to write about it. And so I'm going to do what I've been taught to do. I'm going to pray for the willingness to be willing. And at some point, I will get the willingness I need to open that notebook and, and start writing again, because that's what I need to do. I need another set of steps to, come to terms with, living a life as a sick person. Now, I do want to mention something. There's people that I know that are sick that I've been trying for a couple of years to get to come to our fabulous Higna Thursday Illness and Recovery meeting that I consider my virtual home group. And they don't want to come. And when I asked them why, they said, "I don't identify as a sick person." I'm like, "What? You're a sick person." And I've tried over time to try to understand their perspective, but I can't. And I know why I can't, because the identification that I get from that meeting, and I go to the one in Chicago sometimes too. That identification I get is so important to my life, to my quality of life. I feel when I'm with the people on that meeting on Thursdays, I don't feel alone. I feel safe. I feel like, yeah, these are my people. And I want others to get that same experience that I've got. So I'll keep trying. I keep recommending it. And that's where I'm at today. I'm home. I'm celebrating my anniversary. I was at a party yesterday with like 60 addicts, 50 that have known me for 25 years. And I just looked around and I said, so this is what it's like to not feel alone. Because I'm surrounded by people that know me. They know me. And I'm not close to all of them. I'm close to some of them, but they all know me and they all know my story. And there's something just wonderful about being in a room with a bunch of dope fiends that you've known for 25 years. It's so great. And being in that room and reminiscing about the people that we've lost. I spent a lot of time yesterday talking about the addicts that we've lost. You know, because, and I'll kind of finish up with this. When I was new, there was an old timer, I can't remember who now, who told me that if you work the 12 steps of Narcotics Anonymous and you attend meetings regularly, and you keep working the program, you will live longer than you expect. You will live long enough to get sick, and you will live long enough to lose the people you love. And that is exactly what has happened to me. I have lived a full human life with all the things that happen to us. And I'm so grateful for it. You know, I'm not happy that I'm sick, but, you know, I have a nice little apartment. I can live on my Social Security. There's two or three addicts that help me because I need help now. I can't do everything on my own. I need help. And so far, I'm getting just enough help, you know, and people will come visit me when I'm sick. So, you know, I'm not alone. I'm a member of a tribe, you know, and I'm a member in good standing in that tribe. So, and, you know, I have one simple goal left in life. I don't want to put anyone on my ninth step. Because my ninth step is clean, baby, clean. There's only one name on my ninth step, and it's Keith. And the greatest amends that I could make to Keith right now is to start another set of steps. So I'm going to keep working on that. I'm very grateful to have been asked to speak here today, and I'll keep coming back. Thanks for letting me share.